ground in front of the boxes and his right foot across the aisle on solid machinery. Then, in a short, violent forward explosion, he thrust the sledgehammer's head into the section of pipe fused to the boxes. The compartment thundered with the impact as pieces of encrustation flew from the pipe and hailstormed the room in rust. Chatterton stayed motionless. When the pieces settled to the bottom, he stood, amazed at the sight. The pipe had not moved. And the pipe was not a pipe. Naked and shiny without its encrustation, the object flashed its true identity to Chatterton. This was a 5-foot-tall, pressurized oxygen tank. This was the colossal big brother to the miniature version that had destroyed Chatterton's garage. It was a miracle that the tank had not just exploded. "I need to make a decision," Chatterton said to himself. He flashed through his options. They numbered exactly 2. He could turn and leave the compartment. Or he could take another swing at the giant oxygen tank, which he would have to strike on the cap, its most dangerous spot, in order to shake it loose. "If the thing blows, I won't hear anything," Chatterton thought. "I'll be dead and in a billion pieces. If I leave now, I can leave in one piece." He stepped forward and found Purchase with his feet. When things are easy, a person doesn't really learn about himself. He spread his hands across the sledgehammer's smooth, long handle. It's what a person does at the moment of his greatest struggle that shows him who he really is. He lifted the sledgehammer against his chest. Some people never get that moment. He breathed deeper than he had ever breathed. "The yoo-hoo is my moment." He thrust the head of the sledgehammer toward the cap of the oxygen tank. "What I do now is what I am." The sledgehammer bashed into the tank. The room thundered. Silt flew everywhere. Chatterton waited for the sound of a million sticks of dynamite. He heard only the whoosh of his bubbles leaving his regulator and the clank of falling metal. He peered through the silt. The tank had dropped away from the boxes. He was alive. "Oh, Christ," he said aloud. Chatterton moved toward the boxes, pulled the smallest one free, and stuffed it into his mesh bag. He checked his watch. He had 5 minutes remaining. He swam out of the electric motor room and up toward Kohler's flashlight beam. Though the box was heavy, he managed to hoist it through the gap to Kohler, who passed it to another diver to take to the surface and inspect for tags. By all rights, Chatterton should have exited the diesel motor room then, while he still had 3 minutes of time remaining. He could not. It was possible that the first box did not contain a tag. There were other boxes inside the electric motor room. He needed to retrieve a second box. Kohler desperately flashed his light. Chatterton turned around. A minute later, Chatterton found the second box. This one, however, was even heavier than the first and could not be picked up and swum to Kohler. Instead, Chatterton began to roll it end over end out of the electric motor room. The visibility dropped to 0. Chatterton shined his flashlight on his gauges but could see nothing. The room had gone entirely black. He pushed the box farther, huffing and puffing just to move it another foot closer to Kohler. He pressed his watch against his face mask. He could make out only the vague outline of his timer. He had already stayed longer than planned. He abandoned the box. "I've got to get my ass out of here," he thought. Chatterton swam to the top of the electric motor room so that he could use the ceiling topography to feel his way out of the pitch-black compartment. His navigation was perfect, delivering him to the hatchway that led to the diesel motor room. He was now just a few kicks away from Kohler. He swam forward. Suddenly his head jerked back. A wire noose had caught around his neck. Chatterton was being strangled. He tried swimming backward gently. He could not move. In that small bit of motion, The equipment on his back had become tangled on dangling electrical cables. He was now fully sewn into the wreck. Chatterton knew he did not have time to relax and reverse the process, as was necessary in such a predicament. He knew he would have to fight. From his waiting post, Kohler checked his watch. Chatterton was not just late. He was crazy late. Chatterton pulled at the wire noose around his throat and managed to muscle it off his neck. His breathing quickened even more. He reached up and clawed at the cables that had snared his equipment. Nothing gave. He could not move. He tore harder at the restraints. They hissed in protest and would not loosen. He pulled at them with all he had. Finally, they dropped away. Now free, he dug hard for Kohler, knowing that the slightest additional entanglement would kill him. A moment later, he was there. All that remained was for Chatterton to remove his tank and swim through the gap. He took a breath as he reached for the tank. Only the tiniest trickle of gas came through the regulator. Chatterton knew this sensation. He was a breath from going empty. Chatterton ripped off his tank and shoved it through the crack near the ceiling, then lunged through the space himself. As he reached the other side, he inhaled, but nothing came from his tank. He was entirely out of gas. Chatterton spit the regulator from his mouth. His only remaining hope lay in reaching his stage bottles. But they were outside the compartment and on top of the wreck, a swim of at least 50 feet. He dared not risk buddy breathing with Kohler, as even a slight delay or mix-up in communications could be deadly. Chatterton, his mouth now totally exposed to the ocean, kicked with force and equanimity. He had seen guys die flailing. He was near death. He would not flail. Chatterton torpedoed out of the diesel motor room and up toward the top of the wreck. Kohler, stunned by the sight of his friend without a regulator, gave chase behind him. Chatterton's lungs screamed as his stage bottles came into sight. He kicked harder. Every cell in his body shrieked for oxygen and pulled at his jaws to breathe. He clenched his mouth shut. He reached the stage bottles. In a single motion, he grabbed a regulator from one of the bottles, stuck it in his mouth, and turned the valve. Fresh gas flooded into his lungs. Chatterton had come down to his final breath. A few seconds later, Kohler arrived at his side. He looked Chatterton in the eye, then pointed to his chest, sign language for, "You just gave me a heart attack. Now I'm the one who's going to die instead of you." The divers began their long decompression hang. For nearly 2 hours, Chatterton thought only of the terrible risks he had taken during the dive. Often, he said aloud, "I can't ever let that happen again." He had long since forgotten the spare parts box he had recovered, which Kohler had passed to another diver for tag inspection topside. Near the end of their decompressions, Chatterton and Kohler saw another diver, Will Macbeth, swim down the anchor line. Macbeth handed Chatterton a slate just like the one on which Chatterton had written "sub" during the Discovery trip 6 years earlier. This time, however, the slate said something different. This time it read, "The Yoo-hoo now has a name. It is U-869. Congratulations." In his younger days, Kohler might have jumped for joy and slapped Chatterton on the back. Chatterton might have pumped his fists in triumph. Today they looked into each other's eyes. Then, simultaneously, neither one before the other, each extended his hand. The divers shook. Today they had found something important. Today they had their answers. Epilogue. Chatterton and Kohler identified U-869 in 1997. To this day, mysteries remain. Why did U-869 continue to New York after being rerouted to Gibraltar? How did U-869 meet her end? How did the crew die? The answers to these questions will probably never be known. The U-boat sank with all hands and without witnesses. It is possible, however, to construct a most likely case scenario. That scenario looks like this. The cataclysmic damage to U-869's control room was almost certainly caused by a strike from its own torpedo. U-boats, such as U-869, carried two types of torpedoes in 1945. Normal pattern torpedoes were programmed to run a specific course toward their targets and used a gyroscopic steering mechanism to get there. Acoustic torpedoes were more advanced, homing in on the sound of an enemy ship's propellers. Both types of torpedoes, however, occasionally turned back on their own U-boats. These torpedoes became known as circle runners. U-boats recorded several instances in which circle runners passed beneath or above them. An acoustic circle runner could be especially dangerous, as it chased the sounds of its own submarine's electric motors, pumps, and generators. To avoid being hit, U-boat commanders were ordered to crash-dive immediately after firing an acoustic torpedo. Commanders often had advance warning of circle runners. Torpedo propellers spun at several hundred revolutions per minute and produced a distinct, high-pitched whir-whine audible at great distances to the U-boat's radioman, and then to the entire crew as the weapon drew closer. When a commander got such a warning, he was often able to dive or otherwise change course to avoid the circle runner. History will likely never know how many of the 65 still missing U-boats met their ends by circle runners. By its nature, a circle runner gives little warning and bears no witness. Under ideal conditions, calm seas, good underwater sound propagation, early detection, and fast reporting, Neuerberg might have had 30 seconds or more to respond to the circle runner. In worse conditions, or if the radioman hesitated, or both, he would have had less time. The torpedo would not have blown up instantly upon striking U-869. Instead, there would have been perhaps a one-second delay between contact and detonation as the pistol on the weapon's nose clicked and triggered the explosion. That click, an unmistakable sound to submariners, could be heard even when a torpedo struck a distant target. It would have sounded just long enough before detonation to register in the awarenesses of the crewmen. Most German torpedoes carried between 620 and 780 pounds of high explosives. Based on damage to the wreck, the circle runner likely impacted just below the conning tower, in the center of the submarine. Men located in the boat's control room area, including Neuerberg and Brandt, would have been blown apart and nearly vaporized by the explosion. Men in adjoining rooms likely also died immediately from the concussion or from being hurricaned into machinery. Rippling sheets of air pressure would have rampaged toward both ends of the 252-foot-long submarine, probably slingshotting some crewmen off ceilings and walls and one another, crumpling others like marionettes. Steel doors were blown open. So strong was the blast that it bowed the steel hatch leading into the diesel motor room and blew the steel hatch off the torpedo loading tube in the forward torpedo room, the compartment farthest from the blast's epicenter. The force of the explosion was easily strong enough to blow open the overhead hatches. Hatches, Chatterton and Kohler once speculated, had been opened by crewmen attempting to escape the sinking sub. With the U-boat now open to the ocean, torrents of icy water would have rushed inside. A merciless process of replacing air with water in the sub would have begun, and it would have happened with great sound and violence. Bodies would have been ragdolled off machinery and other structures. Rushing air would have sounded and impacted like a tornado to anyone still alive. Machinery and parts and clothes and tools would have flown at right angles in the furious columns of air rushing from the sub, some of which would have been expelled as ocean debris. No one could have held on. Corpses, some of them likely missing heads or limbs, would have begun a crooked float to the surface. It probably took the U-boat less than 30 seconds to fill with water. The submarine would have sunk to the ocean bottom in less than a minute. If anyone had survived the explosion and somehow made it out of the boat and to the surface, he likely would not have lasted more than an hour in the icy waters. The enemy target ship, now as far as 10 minutes away, its own engines running, wind and water lapping at its sides, would almost certainly have never heard or seen a thing. The most likely explanation for the communications problems between U-869 and Control involves atmospheric conditions, though it is possible that the boat also experienced mechanical problems with its radios. Though Neuerberg might have been hesitant to broadcast for fear of exposing his position to Allied eavesdroppers, the submarine placed itself in no danger by receiving messages from Control. That U-869 continued to New York after Control ordered her to Gibraltar makes it virtually certain that Neuerberg never got the rerouting orders. The fate of U-857, the submarine that had been hunting targets on the American East Coast in April 1945 and was believed for months by Chatterton and Kohler to be the U-Who, remains a mystery. It is still thought lost to unknown causes. The Harbor Inn, a.k.a. the Horrible Inn, no longer exists. Standing in its place in the Brielle, New Jersey parking lot adjacent to the Seeker is the upscale Shipwreck Grill, which serves its nattily dressed customers lobster bisque and honey-roasted salmon with Dijon lobster sauce. Older divers who drop in for a bite swear that if they stay long enough, they can still hear Bill Nagel calling for another Jim Beam. The Seeker, the dive boat conceived and built by Nagel and used to discover and dive the U-Who, continues to run charters. Its current owner, Danny Crowell, goes to the Stolt Dagali, USS Algol, and many other popular wrecks. Crowell rarely runs to U-869. "I'd go if people were interested," he says. "There's just not that many of those kind of divers around these days." A few dive boats, such as Howard Klein's Eagle's Nest and Joe Terzuoli's John Jack, continue to take customers to U-869. Since Chatterton pulled the identifying tag from the wreck in 1997, however, the U-boat has surrendered no important artifacts. Still, Chatterton and Kohler believe that there's a remote chance that Commander Neuerberg's diary survived and lies buried in silt and rubble. Were that diary to be recovered with its writing intact, history would have a first-person insight into the boat's doomed patrol. The technology of deep scuba diving has evolved since Chatterton and Kohler identified U-869. Today, perhaps 95% of deep-wreck divers breathe Trimix, the blended gas believed by many in the early 1990s to be voodoo. About half of deep-wreck divers have abandoned their open-circuit gear, the decades-old tank and regulator combination, in favor of the rebreather, a smaller, computer-controlled device that recycles exhaled air. Rebreathers make very deep dives possible by obviating the need to carry several tanks of decompression gas. They remain, however, more unreliable than open-circuit systems. It is thought that more than a dozen divers worldwide have died using rebreathers. Chatterton was one of the first to adopt the new technology. Kohler has stuck with his open-circuit gear. In 1997, less than a month after he identified U-869, Chatterton and Kathy divorced. A year later, as a member of an elite expedition to Greece, Chatterton became the first person ever to dive HMHS Britannic, the sister ship to the Titanic, using a rebreather. As part of an October 2000 mission to the Black Sea, sponsored by Yad Vashem, the Israeli Holocaust Museum, and the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, he searched for the Struma, an overflowing refugee ship on which 768 people, mostly Romanian Jews, lost their lives fleeing persecution in 1942. In November 2000, PBS's Nova series aired Hitler's Lost Sub, a documentary about the mystery U-boat. The program became one of Nova's highest-rated episodes ever. The same month, Chatterton was diagnosed with metastasized squamous cell carcinoma of the tonsil, likely a result of his exposure to Agent Orange in Vietnam. He was back diving shipwrecks by May of the next year. On September 11, 2001, as terrorist-hijacked planes crashed into the World Trade Center towers, Chatterton was overseeing a commercial dive job under the World Financial Center, directly across the street from Tower 1. He and his divers escaped the area without injury. In January 2002, Chatterton married Carla Madrigal, his girlfriend of 3 years. The couple wed and honeymooned in Thailand, then moved to a beachfront home on the New Jersey shore. In September 2002, Chatterton quit commercial diving after a 20-year career to pursue a history degree and teaching certificate at Keene University in Union, New Jersey. After graduation, he hopes to teach high school or college history. Chatterton and Kohler remain close friends and still dine together at Scotty's. By May 2003, Chatterton's cancer was in remission. In July 2003, he began hosting Deep Sea Detectives, a program about shipwrecks for the History Channel. Kohler even co-hosted on several episodes. Chatterton's involvement with U-869 largely ended the day he identified the wreck. Unlike Kohler, he felt no pressing obligation to find the crewmen's families or to deliver news of their loved ones' fates. "I cared about those things," Chatterton says. "But they were in Richie's heart. There was no one in the world who should have done that besides Richie." The first person Kohler called after he and Chatterton identified U-869 was Tina Marks, his girlfriend. She had believed in him, understood his feelings of obligation to the crewmen and their families, and supported his diving. The couple grew closer. She became pregnant. Tina, however, was being harassed by a former boyfriend who begged her to return to him. She refused. One day in 1998, when Tina was 8 months pregnant with Kohler's child, the man showed up at her door, shot her with a 9mm pistol, then shot himself. The police found both of them lying dead inside the residence. In a moment, Kohler's love and future had disappeared. As it had for years, diving served as his salvation. In 1999, he became co-head of a British-American expedition to identify previously discovered World War I and World War II U-boats sunk in the English Channel. Of 12 target boats, the team identified 4. In the fall of that year, Kohler opened a second branch of Fox Glass in Baltimore. His son, Richie, and daughter, Nikki, who continue to live with him, became honor roll students. Kohler remains a voracious reader of history, though he says he reads differently since his quest to identify U-869. "In the back of my mind, I question a little of everything," Kohler says. "To me, that makes history even more interesting." Kohler's involvement with U-869 entered a new phase after he and Chatterton identified the wreck. In 1997, he set out to find the crewmen's families and deliver them news of their loved ones' fates. With help from Kirk Wolfinger and Rush DeNoyer of Lone Wolf Pictures, who directed the Nova special, and from the German media giant Der Spiegel, which had begun work on a television documentary about the divers and U-869, he found contact information for Barbara Bowling, the half-sister of Otto Brezius, at 17 the youngest of U-869's crewmen. He also found Martin Horenberg's daughter. Bowling, it turned out, had been living for nearly 20 years in Maryland. She and Otto shared the same father, a man who had spoken lovingly of Otto since Barbara had been a baby. All her life, Bowling had grown up admiring and loving this brother she had never known, always believing he lay at the ocean's bottom off Gibraltar. When Kohler visited Bowling at her home, he could hardly believe his eyes. Her son, Mac, was the image of Otto, whose Kriegsmarine photos hung proudly in her house. Bowling, a fluent German speaker, agreed to help Kohler with his further search for family members. Horenberg's daughter was less eager to speak to Kohler. Her mother had remarried after U-869's loss, and her stepfather had raised her as his own. Out of respect to this man, she preferred not to pursue contact with Kohler. Through an intermediary, she expressed gratitude to the divers and supplied them with several photos of her father. Chatterton took the knife off his desktop, a knife that had spoken to him for 7 years, carefully packed the artifact, and drove it to the post office. A week later, the knife belonged to Martin Horenberg's daughter. For a time, Kohler found himself frustrated in his efforts to locate more families. He focused on his personal life and began dating Carrie Bassetti, an executive for a New Jersey pharmaceutical company and the woman who would later become his wife. He had met Bassetti on a wreck diving trip aboard the Seeker, and was moved not just by her passion for diving, but by her innate sense of adventure and old-school appetite for living. By 2001, he had secured excellent contacts with crewmen's families from his source at Der Spiegel. He booked a trip to Germany. He needed to see these relatives in person. Just before departing for Europe, Kohler chartered a boat and took Bowling and her family to the wreck site. There, he read a short memorial he had written, then splashed into the ocean and affixed a wreath and ribbons to U-869. On New Year's Day 2002, accompanied by Bowling as his translator, Kohler landed in Hamburg. He had finally come to do what he had needed to do for years. Kohler's first appointment was with Hans-Georg Brandt, First Officer Siegfried Brandt's younger brother. Now 71 years old and a retired auditor, Hans-Georg waited nervously at his son's home for Kohler's arrival, his son and grandchildren also eager to see the face of one of the divers who had risked his life to find Ziggy. Kohler knocked. Hans-Georg, dressed for the occasion in fine tan slacks, a brown cardigan sweater and a tie, opened the door. For a moment, the men just looked each other over. Then Hans-Georg stepped forward, took Kohler's hand, and spoke in halting English. "I am deeply touched that you have come, and I am so sorry for what happened to the brave divers who lost their lives on the U-boat. Welcome." For 6 hours, Hans-Georg remembered his brother Ziggy, a brother he loved today as much as he had at 13 when Ziggy showed him the secrets of his U-boat and allowed him to look through its periscope out into the world. The conversation was emotional and painful for Hans-Georg at times. At the day's end, Hans-Georg thanked Kohler again and helped him find his coat. "I brought you something," Kohler said. He reached into his briefcase. A moment later he produced a metal schematic he had recently recovered from U-869's electric motor room. "You were probably in this room when you visited your brother," Kohler said. Hans-Georg took the schematic and stared at the metal, at its writing and rust. For several minutes he could not break his gaze from the artifact. Finally, he began tracing his fingers along its edges and over its crusty surface. "I can't believe it," he said. "I will save this forever." The next morning, Kohler and Bowling drove several miles outside Hamburg to meet with a 60-year-old surgeon. The man, thin, tall, and handsome, welcomed the Americans into his home. He introduced himself as Jürgen Neuerberg, the son of U-869's commander, Helmut Neuerberg. Jürgen could produce no memories of his father, as he'd been just 3 years old when U-869 was lost. But he remembered well his mother's stories, and the fondness and love with which she'd told them. For hours, while his wife listened closely, he shared these stories with Kohler, showing dozens of photographs and diary entries in between. "Since I was a child, I believed my father had been lost off Gibraltar," Jürgen said. "When I learned that divers had found the boat off the coast of New Jersey, I was very surprised. But in the end, it did not change how I felt. I suspect it might have shocked my mother, such a revelation after so many years of believing the official version of events. For this reason, I'm happy she never found out about it. She loved him dearly. She never remarried. Caller asked Jorgen if his father had siblings. Indeed, his father had an older brother, Friedhelm. Caller asked if Jorgen might provide a telephone number for Friedhelm. Jorgen gave him an old number. "I don't even know if he's still alive," Jorgen said. "Sadly, we have fallen out of touch." Jorgen and his wife thanked Kohler for his efforts and asked him to thank Chatterton when he returned to New Jersey. That night at the hotel, Kohler and Bowling dialed the number. An elderly woman answered. Bowling introduced herself as the sister of one of U-869's crewmen. The woman said she would be happy to bring her husband to the phone. For the next hour, 86-year-old Friedhelm Neuerberg remembered his brother, Helmut. "When I close my eyes and picture my brother today," Friedhelm said, "I see him doing his duty. I think he had a premonition that he wasn't coming back. He did his duty." In the morning, Kohler and Bowling drove from Hamburg to Berlin. That evening, Kohler met with 40-year-old Dr. Axel Niesle, the head of a private engineering firm that works on waste disposal projects. Niesle's doctorate, earned in water resources science, was based largely on work he did in North Africa. In his spare time, as a sort of hobby, Niesle had made himself the world's foremost authority on the reassessment of U-boat losses. It was Niesle who, in 1994, had thought to look at the intercepted radio messages between U-869 and U-boat control, an idea that had occurred to no one else in the world for history's certainty that U-869 lay sunk off Gibraltar. He'd communicated his findings in a written report to Robert Coppock at the British Ministry of Defense, who then relayed the information to Chatterton and Kohler via letter. During their meeting, Kohler marveled not just at the depth of Niesle's knowledge, but at his passion for the subject. He asked Niesle why he wasn't teaching at a university. "U-boats are my avocation," he said. "Perhaps it would be boring if I were to earn money from it. It's the detective's way of treating these matters that moves me. Once you find out history is wrong, once you start investigating it and, with some luck, correcting it, that is satisfaction enough." The next day, Kohler and Bowling took the Berlin subway to the quaint home of an elderly lady. On a mantelpiece in the living room's center were framed photos of her children and one of a young, handsome man from World War II who seemed to look forward into the ages. The woman introduced herself as Gisela Engelmann. The man in the photo, she said, was her fiancé, Franz Nedel, one of U-869's torpedomen. For hours, Engelmann told Kohler about tearing the eyes out of Hitler's picture, about climbing the gas lamp and displaying Hitler's photo for all Berlin to see, about the going-away party at which Franz and his fellow crewmen broke down in tears, about how she knows more than ever that there is only one true love in a person's life, and for her, that love was Franz. "My two husbands knew about Franz, of course," she said. "When I would speak of Franz to my children, they would roll their eyes and say, 'Mother, you've told us this story 150 times already.'" As with the Brants, Engelmann was left to wonder about her loved one's fate long after the war's end. It was not until October 1947 that she received official word that U-869 had been declared a total loss. "I missed him every day of my life," she told Kohler. "I have his photograph in my bedroom, and I have looked at it every day, through 2 marriages and 4 children, since I waved goodbye to him." Kohler had one more appointment before flying back to New Jersey. He and Bowling flew to Munich, rented a car, and drove west through miles of breathtaking, snow-covered rural landscape. Kohler exited at the small town of Memmingen and followed his directions. A few minutes later, he found himself in the city center, a place of winding streets, centuries-old buildings, and church spires that reached into the heavens. Memmingen, he thought, was a painting. The storybook Germany that Mr. Siegel, the circus strongman, had described to his father. Kohler maneuvered down narrow side streets until he arrived at one of the town's most ancient homes. He rang the doorbell. A minute later, a handsome and dignified 80-year-old gentleman opened the door. Dressed in a blue suit and red tie, his cotton-white hair combed perfectly, he looked as if he had been expecting his visitor for years. "I am Herbert Gostiewski," the man said. "I was the radio man aboard U-869. Please, welcome to my home." In his living room, surrounded by his family, Gostiewski told Kohler the story of how he had survived U-869. On a warm November morning in 1944, just days before U-869 was to leave for war, Gostiewski found himself feeling ill. When he stepped outside for fresh air, he became dizzy and collapsed, unconscious. Onlookers rushed him to the hospital, where he remained in a coma with a high fever for 3 days. When he came to, the doctors told him he had contracted pneumonia and pleurisy. Though U-869 was to depart in hours, he would be forced to remain in intensive care. He was also told he had visitors. His hospital door opened. Standing before him, holding chocolate, cookies, and flowers, was Commander Neuerberg. Behind him were First Officer Brandt and Chief Engineer Kessler. And behind them were many of the U-boat's crew. Neuerberg approached Gostiewski. He wiped the radioman's forehead and stroked his arm. "You'll be all right, my friend," Neuerberg said. Brandt stepped forward and took Gostiewski's hand. "Get well, friend," he said, smiling the same smile Gostiewski had seen after he told Brandt his jokes. "You will pull through." Kessler came forward, as did Horenberg and the other radioman. Many had tears in their eyes. They wished Gostiewski well. "It finally came time to say goodbye," Gostiewski told Kohler. "I had the feeling that we would not see each other again. When I looked into the eyes of some of my comrades, I could see they thought the same." Like everyone else, Gostiewski had believed that U-869 had been sunk off Gibraltar. When he'd got word that divers had found the U-boat off New Jersey, he'd contacted Der Spiegel. It was through Der Spiegel that Kohler had come to know of Gostiewski. Kohler stayed for 2 days. Gostiewski spoke for hours about Neuerberg, Brandt, Kessler, and the other men he knew from U-869. He recounted the bombing of the barracks in Stettin, singing along to Neuerberg's guitar playing, inadvertently dialing in Radio Calais, Fritz Dag's ham theft, his friendship with Horenberg. He spoke at length about Brandt's kindness and ready laugh and his willingness, even at age 22, to bear the fear and trembling of others. He told Kohler that he missed his friends. "It is horrible for me to see the way the boat lies broken in the ocean," Gostiewski said. "For more than 50 years I remembered it as new and strong, and I was part of it. Now I look at the film and pictures and see the remains of my comrades. It is very difficult and sad for me to think of it this way. I believe in God and an afterlife. It would be wonderful to be reunited with my friends, to see them again, and to see them continue in peace, not in war, not in a time when so many young lives were lost for no reason. I would like to see them like that." After a second day of conversation, Kohler and Gostiewski rose and shook hands. Kohler's flight to New Jersey departed in just a few hours, and Gostiewski, an esteemed town councillor, had a meeting that evening. Each had more questions for the other. Each promised another visit so that the questions would not go unanswered for long. As Kohler reached for his coat, Gostiewski made a request. "Might it be possible to send me something from the boat?" Gostiewski asked. "Anything would do. Anything I could touch." "I would be happy to," Kohler said. "I will send you something the moment I return home." He already knew what he would send. A 5-by-6-inch plaque from the emergency life raft canister explaining that item's operation. "That would mean very much to me," Gostchevsky said. He waved goodbye to Kohler and closed the door. As Kohler walked toward his car, he felt the bands of his obligation loosen. No one should lie anonymous at the bottom of the ocean. A person's family needs to know where their loved one lies. It had grown colder outside since Kohler had arrived. He reached for his car keys. Gostchevsky pushed open his front door and walked into the winter. He was not wearing a coat. He moved toward Kohler and put his arms around the diver. "Thank you for caring," Gostchevsky said. "Thank you for coming here." A Note on Sources. John Chatterton and Richie Kohler, the two divers around whom this story revolves, were my business partners in the writing of this book. They gave me full access to their files, photographs, videotapes, notes, and dive logs. I spent hundreds of hours interviewing Chatterton and Kohler at their homes in New Jersey, by phone, by conference call, on the dive boat Seeker, while cruising the Autobahn with Kohler in Germany, while crouching inside the captured German submarine U-505 with Chatterton in Chicago. Their accounts of the quest to identify the mystery U-boat, both in the water and on land, were the foundation upon which this book was written. Each served as the first and most critical check on the other. Upon completing the book, I asked Chatterton and Kohler to review the manuscript for accuracy. Neither was allowed editorial control or input, a condition to which each had agreed before we became partners. Any manuscript changes they suggested were strictly of a technical nature. For accounts of Chatterton's and Kohler's in-water exploration of the U-boat, I relied frequently on their recollection of events. Deep shipwreck diving is a solitary sport in which memory is often the only witness. I viewed videotapes of their dives on those occasions when videotape was shot. I studied photographs of the wreck and consulted Chatterton's and Kohler's handwritten dive logs. I interviewed 14 divers who accompanied them on overnight trips to the wreck, including 9 of the original members of the team that had gone searching for the mystery set of numbers secured from the fishing boat captain by Bill Nagel. The wreck came to life for me through a drawing made by Captain Dan Crowell, the current owner of the Seeker and a longtime diver of the U-boat. His rendering, an amazing work of memory and experience, remained taped to my desk throughout the writing of this book. It is considered by most who have dived the wreck to be a small masterpiece. Several divers, including Steve Gatto, Brian Scarry, Christina Young, and Kevin Brennan, shot excellent underwater photographs of the wreck, which helped me to envision the scenes described to me by Chatterton and Kohler. I also studied photos, diagrams, and plans of Type 9 U-boats in various books, the most useful being Vom Original zum Modell, U-boat Type 9C by Fritz Kohl and Axel Miesle. Equally valuable was the illustrated tour of U-869 provided by PBS on their website for Hitler's Lost Sub, the Nova documentary on the mystery wreck. On numerous occasions, I toured the captured U-505 at Chicago's Museum of Science and Industry. Each of those visits gave me a tangible feel for the Type 9 U-boat, exactly the kind discovered by the divers in 1991. I came to know the dive boat Seeker personally. Captain Dan Crowell showed me the vessel's corners and contours while it was dry-docked in Brielle, New Jersey, then invited me on an overnight trip to also hunt mystery numbers to a location about 70 miles offshore. The seas were constantly violent, and I was tossed from my bunk several times. There is no more immediate way to understand a dive boat's character, foibles, and nobility than to spend 24 hours aboard it in the middle of an angry Atlantic. Many of the stories about deep-wreck diving contained in this book were told to me by Chatterton and Kohler, as well as by other divers, boat captains, and witnesses. Because the sport is so dangerous and has so few participants, probably just a few hundred in the United States, many of its stories remain oral history. Whenever possible, these stories were checked with the principals involved. Occasionally, witnesses provided slightly different accounts of events, especially when their stories were of close calls or fatalities, and they had been panicked, distracted, or distressed. Those inconsistencies were slight. When they occurred, I used the consensus version of events to conclude, say, that a diver had been underwater for 10 minutes rather than 12. For the deaths of the Texas Tower diver and of Joe Drozd, Chatterton was present and a witness to events. For the death of Steve Feldman, I interviewed nearly all of the divers present, including Feldman's dive partner, Paul Skibinski, Doug Roberts, and Kevin Brennan, who were in the water and witnessed much of the unfolding disaster, and John Hildeman and Mark McMahon, who did the dangerous sand sweeps searching for Feldman on the ocean's bottom. I also inspected the written accounts of the incident provided to the Coast Guard by each diver after returning to shore. For George Place's close call, I interviewed Place and Howard Klein, the captain of the Eagle's Nest, who set out to rescue his stricken diver. Kohler was present and a witness to that event as well. For Dr. Lewis Cole's close call, I interviewed Cole, his dive partner John Yerga, and Chatterton and Kohler. All were present and witnessed the event. For the deaths of Chris and Chrissy Rouse, I relied on interviews with Chatterton, Kohler, Yerga, and Crowell, all of whom were present and participated in the rescue attempt and subsequent recovery of equipment. I also read Bernie Chowdhury's book, The Last Dive, A Father and Son's Fatal Descent into the Ocean's Depths, from HarperCollins, which recounts the Rouse tragedy and is a very good account of the dangers of deep diving. I gleaned insight into the culture of wreck diving in the American Northeast by spending time with and interviewing divers and boat captains. Bucky McMahon's story, Everest at the Bottom of the Sea, published in the July 2000 issue of Esquire, was exceedingly useful to me and remains perhaps the best account ever written of Andrea Doria diving and the characters who challenged that legendary wreck. Kevin F. McMurray's book, Deep Descent, Adventure and Death, Diving the Andrea Doria, from Pocket Books, was also helpful to me in digesting the long and dangerous history of the Doria and the psyches of those who dive it. The physiology of deep-water scuba diving was made understandable to me by several books, the most useful of which was Tim Eacott's Neutral Buoyancy, Adventures in a Liquid World, from Atlantic Monthly Press. Eacott writes beautifully, not just about diving physiology, but about the transcendent potential of scuba exploration. His work was inspiring. Physiologist R.W. Bill Hamilton was patient with me in explaining some technical aspects of deep scuba. The life and times of Bill Nagel were described to me by Chatterton, Kohler, Yerga, Crowell, and Andrew Nagel. Nearly every diver and boat captain I interviewed had something to say about Nagel's legend. Captain Skeets Frink was very helpful to me in explaining how Nagel came to possess the numbers to the mystery wreck. I learned about Atlantic wreck divers' history and culture from Kohler, one of the group's original members, as well as from Pete Guglieri, John Lackenmeyer, and Pat Rooney. I talked to numerous sources about the age-old rivalries between dive boat captains. McMurray's Deep Descent and Gary Gentile's The Lusitania Controversies, Book 2, Dangerous Descents into Shipwrecks and Law, from Gary Gentile Productions, were also useful to me along those lines. For information on Steve Feldman, I interviewed his dive partner, Paul Skibinski, as well as his friends Tommy Cross, Marty Dick, John Hopkins, Andrew Ross, and boat captain Paul Hepler. For the lives of Chris and Chrissy Rouse, Chowdhury's The Last Dive was interesting. For the lives of Chatterton and Kohler, I spoke to their ex-wives, current wives, friends, and family. For Chatterton's Vietnam experience, I interviewed John Lacko, with whom Chatterton saw combat, and Dr. Norman Sakai, a battalion surgeon who served with Chatterton. Charles Kinney, a former Vietnam medic and author, provided an enlightening overview of the medic's place in the Vietnam War. I relied on several sources to confirm the process and substance of Chatterton's and Kohler's research. Their files contained copies of many of the original historical documents they used to pursue the identity of the mystery U-boat, including attack reports, analyses of anti-submarine action, radio intercept intelligence summaries, translations of U-boat control diary entries, and incident reports. In rare instances in which the divers gleaned information from historical documents they had not or could not have copied, I used books and consulted with experts to confirm the information. Invaluable to me in this endeavor, and many others, was Clay Blair's superbly researched and astonishingly complete two-volume set, Hitler's U-Boat War, published by Random House. In these volumes, Blair includes information from both the German and Allied sides, which is not true of every book on the subject. While covering the operational, technical, and intelligence aspects of the U-boat war with rare readability and insight. The set was the single most useful written resource I used while writing Shadow Divers. On countless occasions, German naval researcher Axel Nesle confirmed or refined the accuracy of Chatterton's and Kohler's research. I inspected dozens of letters between the divers and various sources with whom they corresponded about the mystery U-boat, many of which helped me understand the mood, evolution, and maturity of their research. At the Naval Historical Center in Washington, D.C., I interviewed Dean Allard, Bernard Cavalcanti, William Dudley, and Kathleen Lloyd, all of whom spoke to me about the divers' methods, resources, approach, and character. Timothy Mulligan at the National Archives in Washington was similarly helpful. On the subject of the Civil Air Patrol and its possible role in the sinking of the mystery sub, I spoke to Lieutenant Colonel Gregory Weidenfeld of that organization, and also read his monograph on the topic, The Search for the Hagen Farr Subkill. On the subject of blimps and U-boats, I interviewed Gordon Vaith, former intelligence officer for the Atlantic Fleet Airships during World War II, and benefited greatly from his book, Blimps and U-Boats, U.S. Navy Airships in the Battle of the Atlantic, published by Naval Institute Press. The personal letters of U-boat ace Carl Friedrich Merton, written to Chatterton in the early stages of the divers' research, helped me understand that officer's opinion about the mystery wreck. Most newspaper accounts cited in the book were saved by Chatterton and Kohler and kept in scrapbooks, and were easily checked. Finally, I studied the divers' extensive research notes, which chronicled not just their findings, but often their mindsets. In very rare cases where opinions in published sources or between experts conflicted, I relied on Blair's Hitler's U-Boat War. To learn the history of the U-boat war, no source was more valuable to me than Blair's books. I also relied regularly on a website, uboat.net, the best internet resource for information on U-boat history, commanders, the fates of various submarines, and much more. It is virtually impossible to research U-boats without utilizing this excellent, thorough, and well-designed resource. The transcript to Nova's program, Hitler's Lost Sub, available at the aforementioned PBS website, was also useful for its interviews with various scholars and U-boat veterans. For the histories and fates of individual U-boats, other than U-869, Blair's books were a primary source, as was Nesle's German U-boat losses during World War II, Details of Destruction, from Naval Institute Press. When I needed information on U-boats that I could not find, I called or wrote to Niesley, who was always helpful. Statistics on U-boats and U-boat losses vary widely among the many books and articles published on the subject. My figures were taken from the above-mentioned book by Niesley. A German private researcher, Niesley is among the most original minds writing about U-boats, and continues to work at the forefront of re-examining U-boat losses. His book, in addition to providing many of the most current U-boat statistics, also includes an excellent explanation of post-war assessment mistakes, the very kinds of mistakes that made the mystery at the core of this book so difficult to solve. For information on the lives and times of U-boat crewmen, I constantly referred to Timothy Mulligan's excellent book, Neither Sharks Nor Wolves, The Men of Nazi Germany's U-Boat Arm, 1939-1945, from Naval Institute Press. The book, set against the context of the larger war effort and the changing fate of Germany, is a classic overview of the men who fought the U-boat war. Mulligan, an archivist who specializes in captured German and World War II-era records, based much of his research on surveys of over 1,000 U-boat veterans. I read several books by Jack P. Malman Schaul, many of which can be commended for painting incisive pictures of life aboard the U-boats, the command structure of the U-boat force, and the men who manned these vessels. The most useful to me among them was U-Boats Under the Swastika, published by Naval Institute Press. At just 132 pages, it provided a fine and easily digestible primer. I spent invaluable time in Toronto with Werner Hirschmann, the former chief engineer of U-190. In a few days with Mr. Hirschmann, I learned more about U-boat life than I might have in years of reading. In learning about the history, fate, and crew of U-869, I benefited greatly from the following sources. For the life and career of Commander Helmut Neuerberg, I inspected his military records and interviewed his son, Jürgen, and brother, Friedhelm, in Germany. Neuerberg's first name is spelled in various ways by various sources. I used H-E-L-M-U-T-H, as that is how he appeared to sign his own name on his military records. For the life and career of First Officer Siegfried Brandt, I inspected his military records, interviewed his brother Hans-Georg Brandt and his friends Clemens Borkert and Heinz Schley in Germany. For the life and career of torpedoman Franz Nedel, I interviewed his fiancée, Gisela Engelmann, in Germany. I devoted several days in Germany to interviewing Herbert Guschewski, the former radioman on U-869. It was through Guschewski that I gleaned insight into the sub's crew and officers, especially Neuerberg, Brandt, and Martin Horenberg, the U-boat's senior radioman. Many stories and details of U-869's training came from these interviews with Mr. Guschewski, as well as from the boat's training diary. General information about U-boat training, some of which informed the chapters on U-869's training, was taken from several books, most notably Mulligan's Neither Sharks Nor Wolves, as well as from my interviews with Werner Hirschmann. I was able to accurately envision the crew of U-869, as well as the submarine itself, thanks to dozens of photographs of the men and their boat, some of which were taken by the Kriegsmarine, others of which were given to Chatterton and Kohler by family members of the crewmen and by Mr. Guschewski. I was able to reconstruct U-869's doomed patrol, thanks in part to Niesley's 1994 breakthrough monograph, The Loss of U-869. It was this written report that changed the thinking about the fate of U-869 and, indirectly, advanced the divers' efforts to identify the mystery wreck. Also invaluable was Blair's summary of the patrol in Volume 2 of Hitler's U-boat war. Text from Allied intelligence analysis of radio intercepts between U-869 and U-boat control were taken from copies of those analyses. Over the course of a lengthy in-person interview in Germany, Niesley helped me to envision the most likely scenario to explain and describe U-869's final moments. Finally, I accompanied Kohler to Germany in 2002. My account of his trip is taken from my own experience.